separate appeals arising from the same trial at the circuit court. The counsel are the same, however, they're different. One's the appellant one time and the appellee the next time. Mr. McLaughlin, you'll be the appellant in the first case. You need not move after that case to the appellee's table. You stay right where you are. The clerk will now call both cases.
Fidelity Bakery Condominium Association, Inc. versus Fidelity Bakery et al. Henry W. McLaughlin, Appellant Counsel. Adam G. Winkler, Michael E. Lacey, John C. Lynch, Daniel C. Berger, for the appellees. Gaddams et al. Versus Fidelity Bakery Condominium Association. Adam G. Winkler, Michael E. Lacey, John C. Lynch, Daniel C. Berger, for the appellants. Henry W. McLaughlin, for the appellees.
You may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, I request to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
I submit that the strongest argument from my client's side in this case is that is the obstruction case, except for the counts that relate to what happened the 2 years before we filed suit as to the happily directors. The main damage that was done in this case had to do with cost shifting and a decision by the developer to use the control that the developer had over the corporation to not to assess sufficient funds to pay for the cost and to therefore shift those funds over to related purchases. I don't think there's really any question about the fact that the association could not file suit as long as he controlled the board. There had to be a sending of a cure notice, and that was never going to happen during the 8 years, which is unusual in these cases, during which Mr. Gaddams controlled this board through his employees. And so the argument that has been made by the appellees in this case is that, notwithstanding that there could have been derivative suits brought by individual unit owners, one or more. The problem with that argument, I submit, is that there was no, the cost shifting did no damage to those unit owners. During the time that this cost shifting took place, the unit owners at that time were innocent beneficiaries of the cost shifting actions and the conspiracy that went with it, and they were never damaged by it.
But aren't the claimants in a derivative action really seeking the interest of the entity?
I'm sorry.
Aren't the claimants in a derivative action seeking the interest of the entity rather than their own individual interests?
Well, yes, but yes, sir. Yes, sir. That is absolutely so. But the individual persons would have no reason to bring such a suit because they weren't being damaged by it. They had no incentive to go to the expense, to hire a lawyer, to do any of those things, because although they were not the cause of the cost shifting, in fact, they were benefiting from it. The only people who lost from it were the later purchasers, and those later purchasers, according to the theory of the appellees, they never had, there was a wrong against their interest that they never had a right to do anything to prevent. So because of the fact that the present unit owners were not being damaged at all, the entity which had the reason to bring this was the association itself, which I think is what your Honor's question points out, is that the association was a part of damage, except that Mr. Gaddams controlled that association, and for his own benefit, according to what was alleged, which is taken as true purposes of this, of the case and this appeal, he prevented that from happening. There was no opportunity for the association to file the suit. And so the argument I submit that individual owners who had no incentive to do it, no benefit to do it, and nothing to benefit them for the cost of going through that, it was illusory to say that there was a way in which this could have been filed, that this obstruction could have been overcome by anybody. The only way someone would have done this would have been simply purely a matter of principle, out of an interest in doing it. And of course, it's risky. As we know from this other case, there's going to be an argument by the individual fiduciaries that they're entitled to their attorney's fees if they win, regardless of the equities of it, regardless of whether or not they acted in good faith or bad faith, that argument is being made. So I submit it's illusory to think or to hold that the individual unit owners should have brought suit, could have brought suit, and it was realistic for them to do so, anything other than illusory, and therefore I submit the obstruction.
And you may be right on all of that, but then we have a tolling provision in 801.229 talks about obstructing. Is that what you're relying on, or are there other things that you can point us to? I mean, we have a statute of limitations. That's right, black and white. We know what that is. And you want it told, so we have to figure out a mechanism. Even if you're right, we have to figure out a mechanism to get... So fairness is great. How about law? So what is the case law or the statutory hook that gets us to the tolling?
It's the obstruction statute, which is quite explicit. It says that a statute of limitations can be told if the defendant obstructs.
Right, so obstruction, you think normally, is some kind of obstacle someone is putting in your path. You know, they're concealing things or they're whatever. But the statute seems to have a somewhat more diluted concept of obstruction because it talks about filing a petition in bankruptcy. Well, that could be a perfectly legitimate thing to do. I don't think a bankruptcy is some kind of skullduggery. It's just a legal vehicle somebody can use. But so I take it you've got 229D, little Romanet 2, direct or indirect means to obstruct. So here, what's tricky about this case is what you're saying is the filing of a derivative suit is futile and just sort of nonsensical. And that may be right, but that's a little different than obstructing.
Okay, well, I thank you for the question. What I meant about the derivative suit is that seems to be a primary argument of the appellee is
right.
That obstruction doesn't apply because of the derivative. But to go to your point, I submit that the language indirect is very important here and supports our case. Here you have a developer who, contrary to the usual course of events in which they sell the units, they take a two-year right of control and sell the units, did not sell those units and kept control and maintained the control of the institution during the time when there was this period during which the institution itself, the association, could have brought the suit. And by maintaining this control...
And you say in violation at some point,
yes,
of the agreement itself, when a certain number of units had been sold, nevertheless control was maintained.
And they didn't have... They violated the bylaws, they didn't hold meetings... But by all of this, there was a fiduciary obligation on this board to act on behalf of the institution. It took no action to file that suit, and that is certainly an indirect means of obstructing the institution from filing suit. And furthermore, they never sent a cure notice, which they would have had to have done to file the suit. And so if we look at things in real-world terms, they obstructed this lawsuit by in fact, keeping control. And And it was, and the argument of the...
But is it, it had the effect of obstructing the lawsuit, but it's an indirect way.
Indirect. And I think that the General Assembly wanted to cover the waterfront by saying that. You look to the real world of what actually happened, and it may have been, I think, reasonable to conclude that this was an indirect way to do it, but it was completely effective. No way could there be any way to redress this cost shifting. And I would say on this subject that what the appellees are saying is that today, yesterday, tomorrow, any developer can use this mechanism to enrich itself. And there's no, unless somebody changes the law through the General Assembly, there's no recourse. And I would ask this court to rule against that, because I submit that this is a case in which they acted in such a manner as to make it impossible for anybody to get relief from this until such time as there was a change in the board. And not that long after that, certainly within 2 years, this suit was filed.
Can you point me specifically to the allegations of obstruction and concealing or hiding actions, those kinds of things that would justify tolling under that statute? Can you give
I'm
me
sorry,
the specific?
Could you say it again?
Can you point me to the specific allegations on concealment and obstruction?
Well, I don't know that we said that it was concealment. What we said was it was obstruction.
Okay, well, where are the allegations of obstruction that would justify it under the statute?
We have that specifically cited in the complaint. You know, it's not the duty of a complaint to preclude a statute of limitations, but knowing that this was coming, we, in the complaint, specifically said that this was, that the statute was told by the obstruction statute.
Well, that's a conclusion. My question is...
Oh, well, we said that they did it by keeping control, and therefore it was just the same thing I've just been arguing.
Okay.
It's all in the complaint.
But you realize that the logic of what you're saying is simply whenever you commit it, when a tortfeasor commits a tort, in this case, alleged fiduciary duty breach, that it's obstruction if nobody is incentivized to complain about it. That's an awful broad use of the concept, and I'm not familiar with it.
Well, I submit you go to what actually happens. The obstruction statute does not have to do with a notice, and as I've said, one of the issues here is that the people who owned the units at that point had no reason to complain because they were innocent beneficiaries.
You have 3 minutes and 15 seconds left.
May it please the court, my name is John Lynch, and I'm representing the appellees in this portion of the appeal. This is an 8-year conspiracy by their own allegations of the plaintiff in this case. I do want to talk about the procedural history of the case because we're talking about merits a lot. The circuit court decided this special plea taking all of the factual allegations as true. And that was clear, and that's the reason an evidentiary hearing wasn't conducted, and the judge took those allegations as true, which I think is important because the two assignments of error, 1 and 2, both on counts 2 and 5, opposing counsel talks about there being a dispute of material facts, and there is no dispute of material facts. So we believe those two assignments of error, both on counts 2 and 5, are an error because it was clear that the circuit court took the allegations as true. So that assignment of error, we believe, shouldn't be heard by this court. Assignments 3 and 4 relate to the tolling provisions, and I'd like to talk about the obstruction, which seems to be relied on by opposing counsel the most. The issue on the derivative action has been decided by the Grimes, this court's decision in the Grimes case in 2001, and in Birchwood in 2015. In the Birchwood case, this court said that neither breaches of fiduciary duty nor irreconcilable conflicts of interest of a board of direction of directors told the statute of limitations under the obstruction statute. And then the Grimes case in 2001 said if a derivative suit was impractical or there wasn't any type of incentive, that isn't a grounds for obstruction. This court has always said obstruction has to be an affirmative act to prevent or obstruct the filing of the lawsuit. One thing I'm going to disagree with...
And the argument here is a little different. It's affirmative act that... anybody could have marched into the courthouse and filed the lawsuit. They weren't concealing notes or evidence or whatever. Argument is, by retaining control and violation of the agreement, they essentially made it impractical or they disincentivized the filing of a lawsuit, which is a kind of a stretch for obstruction, but then the statute talks about indirect means. And that's how your opposing counsel tries to bridge that problem.
So what would be any difference from this situation from a normal condominium situation where you have a bunch of people that control a board? And you have someone who's in a condominium unit who's an owner. And what happened here, this obviously got constructed in 2006, horrible economy. The developer rented the units for a long period of time, then started selling them, and then you had individual unit owners. Those individual unit owners, once they started owning these units, they had access and were given, you know, what the reserves were. They had the incentive on behalf, just like you said, about filing a derivative action on behalf of the association. And talking about the disincentive, if your condo association doesn't have adequate reserves, you have an incentive because you want to make sure when repairs are needed or common elements need to be repaired, or just like any other condominium association, you would have an incentive to bring that action. Again, do I realize maybe it might not be always be practical for an individual unit owner to file a, I'm not going to stand up in front of you and say that someone's just going to run off to the courthouse. But they did have that ability to file, and nothing was preventing them or obstructing them. At most, it was impractical. And the Grimes, this court in Grimes in 2001 said just because a derivative action was impractical doesn't mean that's obstruction. So there's no affirmative act of obstruction here. And I realize the facts are a little, even taking them as true, a little strange because you had a situation where a condominium developer kept control of the board because he was renting them out. I mean, this it was either renting them out or go to bankruptcy court. The economy in 2006 up in the Churchill area, and anybody that owns condos knows at that time period you were in trouble. That condominium unit was going under, so they had to rent them, and then when it was time to sell, they would sell as many as they could, and when this sufficient number was sold, then there was a change of control with the board. But once there were individual sales, those people could have filed these derivative actions, and I don't believe under the case law, both the Birchwood case and the Grimes case, you know, we believe undermine and have already spoken to the issues that are being advocated. The other theory that opposing counsel has put forth is the kind of what I'll call the continuing conduct or the continuing treatment rule that this court has adopted in legal malpractice. Also, I believe, is adopted in accounting malpractice. We believe that doesn't apply here and shouldn't be extended to this situation at all, because there are separate acts that occurred during. It wasn't one undertaking. It wasn't one representation by the board. Different board members came in and out at different times. Also, you have different allegations of wrongdoing. It was... You know, one claim obviously is not having the sufficient amount of reserves. Another claim is, you know, getting a bonus on getting tenants or telephone bills or certain improper fees. There's some of those allegations during the 8 years. And we believe this court, it would not be wise, and there's no authority to extend the continuing conduct rule for some sort of extension of the statute of limitations. This court has said in numerous cases that if there's a doubt about statute of limitations, the doubt should be resolved in favor of the case being time-barred. This is 8 years.
Counsel, to the extent that there are separate acts that would militate against the continuing conduct rule, why isn't there merit to his argument that each time they failed to adopt a budget, or at least in 2014 when they realized there was a shortfall and they failed to adopt a budget to address that, why wouldn't that be a separate breach that would be actionable?
Okay. And thank you for, because I wanted to raise that point. So their allegations in the complaint is for the whole 8 years that inadequate reserves were maintained and reserves were never brought to a sufficient level. And in the complaint they said for 8 years the budgets were improperly adopted because they did not have sufficient reserves just in the budget. So the two claims are, did your budget have enough reserves? And even if your budget didn't during the year, did you determine that more reserves were needed? That those breaches occurred starting in 2006, and that damage occurred starting in 2006. And we believe under this court's Forest Lake decision in 2017 and the Westminster case in 1989 that those were just, you know, they already occurred and they just kept repeating itself over and over.
Even to the extent that it repeated itself, when it repeated itself, why didn't it trigger the statute of limitations anew?
So, and even if you don't buy into those to that body of case law from this court, the 2014 budget was adopted in December of 2013, and that is confirmed. It's in the record, and that's 2 years before the breach of fiduciary duty expired. So that's time barred.
Well, what about the 2015 budget?
So the 2015 budget was adopted by a new board, and that is
right. So why is there not, following up on Justice Powell's question, why is there not a standalone claim that arose after the reserve study was done in March of 2014?
So the reserve studies are a red herring. The reserve studies, you hire someone and they do an analysis of your condo and say, do you need more money or not? And that isn't something that is a claim. That's just a fact. The 2015 budget, Judge, was adopted by the new board. And that was done in 2014. So how could that be a claim against my clients? That's been admitted in page 235 of the appendix, and it's paragraph 111 of the amended complaint. They actually applaud themselves, the new board, for taking over in 2014 and adopting the 2015 budget. So the
but the old board didn't, knowing that there was a shortfall between March 2014 and November 2014.
So what could possibly be the claim? The 2015 budget was adopted by the new board in 2014. So the 2014 budget was adopted in 2013. So during that time period of 2014, I guess is what you're asking about, before
right.
the new board
right,
took over,
exactly.
That's just a continuation of the conduct that occurred for the last 8 years. No affirmative act after December of 2013 did this board take. No affirmative act at all. They saw a reserve study and that was it. And that's the same activity that occurred for the prior 8 years. And that cause of action already accrued, the injury already accrued. It can't be a separate cause of action because it's just a continual conduct. The damage may have changed. That reserve study may have showed the amounts that were needed to correct. The shortfalls may have gone up or down, but that same conduct, based on the allegations, had been occurring for the last 6 or 8 years.
So if we're analogizing your fact pattern, which is hard to do, to our existing case law, and suppose for the sake of argument we analogized it to the Hampton Roads sanitation situation, ongoing pollution, but episodic events. And in between the episodic events, there was no continuation of the pollution event, in contrast to Forest Lakes. Are you saying, and I think you are saying, but let me make sure, that even if we were to take that view in your case, the last pollution event, so to speak, was December of 2013, and all the damage that's being claimed in this suit arose either as a result of the 2013 failure to adopt a proper budget and the prior ones, which are all beyond the statute. So, one, is that what you're saying? And two, if that's what you're saying, doesn't it moot the whole argument as to whether or not we're looking at, because it's a very esoteric point, you know, when accruals reaccrue. I mean, it's incredibly esoteric. And it's never easy to figure that out. And every fact pattern is different. Do we really need to get into that if your main thesis is right?
Yeah, and my main thesis is what I'm advocating, is that it's the Forest Lake situation, not the Hampton Roads Sanitation District. If you look at the allegations in this complaint, they say a continual conduct under 6D of having inadequate reserves, and then under 6B and 3B having an inadequate budget every single year.
Well, let's give them the benefit of the doubt, arguendo, and say every time they fail to adopt a proper budget is a new cause of action that accrues at that moment in time. The last moment in time, as I understand your argument, is December 2013.
Yes, and I'm making that argument just because if the court believes that it is some sort of episodic, the last act was still time barred. But I believe if you look at the allegations, this issue of the 2014 budget, they even admit it occurred in 2013. So nothing occurred in 2014 that could potentially be a new cause of action.
When did they get the assessment, counsel, that showed they were woefully underfunded?
December 24th, 2013. It is page 433 of the appendix. And that's when the 2014 budget was given to the unit owners.
Could they breach their fiduciary duty by failing to act? They could breach their fiduciary duty by failing to act.
I think I agree with you, Judge, you can breach fiduciary duty by failing to act, but that would be the exact same allegation that had been made from 2006 through when they resigned or when they were off the board in November of 2014, and they violated 6D by not maintaining adequate reserves and by not adopting proper budgets. That cause of action, that's what the Westminster case says. If it's the same action, it's only been one breach and the injury started back, and the injury has just gotten, according to plaintiffs, has gotten larger. There has been no new causes of action. There's been no new injuries. The same injury started in the very beginning when you didn't fund the adequate reserves in the beginning. And that's it. If you look at their allegations in paragraph 99 of the amended complaint, they talk about it just repeatedly. There was no reserves that were maintained, and all of the budgets, they kept up that same conspiracy of not having enough reserves.
Well, and the failure to act point proves too much, because they can enact an amended budget at any time. And so that's a continuous duty. So it's one thing to pinpoint a specific budget, you should enact it. But the failure to act, well, that's a continual thing because it exists at all times.
Under 6D, no question, Judge, that the whole time this was a continual board, you knew you didn't have enough reserves, and for 8 years you did nothing about it. Thank you. My time is...
Mr. McLaughlin, you have 3 minutes and 15 seconds.
May it please the court, I believe Appellee's counsel inadvertently misstated the Birchwood Manassas case. If I heard him correctly, I think he said that case held against the obstruction statute.
Mr. McLaughlin, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but can I bring you back to some of the questions that the court just recently asked your opponent? If, in fact, it is alleged, and I think it is alleged, correct me if I'm wrong, that it was a tort in December 2013, a breach of fiduciary duty, to not properly fund the reservoir of assets necessary to keep this going, not do the proper budget. And they did a budget, but the budget was all wrong and a breach of their fiduciary duties. Well, prima facie, if that's true, it's a tort, and it occurred and it accrued in December 2013. What happened after that, other than failing to fix the tort that they already did, what happened after that that's affirmative that could possibly constitute a new cause of action as opposed to an old one that didn't fix?
Thank you for the question. There were two things that happened after that. The first study that was made happened within the 2 years before the suit was filed.
Okay, a study comes in, they need to do something, they don't do something. But the reason they don't do something is because they already had done something, December 13, which is we're not going to worry about any of this.
They had a duty under the bylaws to adopt a new budget by November the 1st, which they did not do. They had two different things happen. One, they were given information which was specific for that the reserves were inadequate. They did nothing to correct that during this period that was within the 2 years, and they had an affirmative duty to adopt a new board budget. Could have been done soon after they got this information.
But why isn't that argument simply saying a tortfeasor commits a tort, and for purposes of accrual, it's continually accruing if they don't fix the tort they've already committed, if they don't take care of it and remedy it?
Well, under the continuing issue, I submit that the issue there becomes that there's a new requirement that they adopt a new budget and they have new information, and they did not do that. And they, in adopting a new budget, they had an obligation to act according to their fiduciary duty, and not to adopt any budget was a violation of that duty.
Assume for the sake of argument there's no continuing duty concept applicable to fiduciaries in an entity like this. It's limited to professional malpractice. Assume that arguendo. Is there a new tort that accrued in the 2 years prior to filing, and what exactly was it?
It was the failure to correct the problem after they got notice and failure to meet their obligation to adopt a new thing. I only have 8 seconds. I just want to say the Birchwood decision specifically said it did not, that the party there did not claim tolling under any statute.
All right. The court will now hear Gaddams versus the Nolde Bakery Condominium Association, Incorporated. Mr. Lynch.